Want to support Clock Tower Media and look great while doing it? Check out our official merchandise store, packed with gear inspired by our podcasts and productions. From the Spooky Spectre Sisters apparel to merchandise celebrating your favorite Clock Tower Media shows, we've got something for every fan. Not only will you be showing your support, but every purchase helps us continue creating the content that you love. Visit clocktowermediashop.forthwall.com and grab your favorite merch today.
Welcome to episode 2 of the Sleepy Time Grammar Podcast, presented by Dragonfly Editorial. In this podcast, we talk about some of the things we love: parts of speech, grammar rules, literature, language, and writing conventions, all in the most relaxing way possible. And frankly, that's what we're all about at Dragonfly. We're a content agency. That means we write things, design things, and edit things. But our real goal is to take stress off our customers' shoulders and help them lead a more relaxing life. So, listen along to our podcast. You can listen while you're doing creative work, doing laundry, washing the dishes, or relaxing on the couch. And if you happen to fall asleep, all the better. But there's no pressure to sleep. This is your time to relax and let your cares drift away, to be replaced by the wonderful world of words. In this episode, we're going to talk about one of the most basic parts of speech in the English language, nouns. And to do so, we'll turn to the resources that are most important to us as writers and editors. Things like Garner's Modern English Usage, the Chicago Manual of Style, the AP Style Book, and other resources that are loved by me and important to me. I'm Samantha Enslin, president of Dragonfly Editorial, and let's dive in to the Sleepy Time Grammar Podcast. Usually on our podcast, we start with definitions of the term that we're discussing that day. And to hear the definition of a noun, we're going to turn to the Chicago Manual of Style. Now, I'm looking at the 17th edition, which coincidentally was published in 2017 by the University of Chicago Press. It's the brilliant blue version. The newest version, edition 18, is bright yellow, and I'm eager to get that on my bookshelf as soon as possible. So, let's see what edition 17 says about nouns. They say, a noun is a word that names something, whether it's abstract or concrete. It may be a common noun, which is the name of a generic class or type of person, a place, a thing, a process, activity, or condition. Or it may be a proper noun, which would be the name of a specific person, place, or thing, and thus capitalized. A concrete noun may be a count noun. In other words, if it can be counted, as with horses or cars. Or it might be a mass noun, if what it names is uncountable or collective, like with information or salt. For example, you could count the number of salt crystals, but you can't really count just the number of salt. You either have a bunch of salt or a little salt. For example. Now, Chicago goes on to give us some more information about these three classes of nouns: common, proper, and mass. So let's look at these in a little bit more detail. Chicago reminds us that a common noun is the generic name of one item in a class or a group. For example, a chemical, a river, or a pineapple. It's never capitalized unless it begins a sentence or appears in a title. A common noun is usually used with a determiner, that is, an article like a or an, or another word like some or few that would indicate the number and definiteness of the noun element. For example, they say a loaf, the day, or some person. So now we go on to have a little bit more detail about proper nouns. And if you listened to Schoolhouse Rock when you were a kid, you know that a proper noun is the name of a person, place, or thing. And they cite the examples of John Doe, Moscow, the Hope Diamond. That would be a great noun to have. I'd love to have that one. They also note that a proper noun can be the title of a work, like Citizen Kane, or my favorite movie of 2025, Sinners. Proper nouns may be singular, like Mary or London, or plural. For example, the Great Lakes or the Twin Cities. A proper noun is always capitalized, regardless of how it's used, unless someone is purposely flouting the rules. And they cite an example as the musician K.D. Lang, who always lowercases both the K and the D in her name, as well as the L in Lang. So now we go on to mass nouns. And this is a kind of interesting type of noun because it denotes something that's uncountable, either because it's abstract, like a concept such as cowardice or justice, or because it refers to an aggregation of people or things that are taken as what they call an indeterminate whole. For example, luggage or the bourgeoisie. They note there's a key difference between mass nouns and collective nouns, which we're going to talk about in a minute. And they say that unlike collective nouns, which are count nouns, mass nouns almost never take an indefinite article, that's like a or an, and they typically, this is interesting, do not have a plural form. For example, we can say a team, but not an evidence or a justice. We can say two groups, but not two luggages. A mass noun can also stand alone. For example, music is more popular than ever. Or it can stand with a determiner other than an indefinite article, like some music or the music. But again, we would never say a music. So one thing that's interesting, Chicago, which is one of the most comprehensive style guides that we can use, doesn't really have a lot to say about collective nouns, other than to note that they are count nouns. So we're going to turn to the AP style book, that is the Associated Press style book, for a little bit more detail on this and how to use collective nouns. BTW, you can always find this at apstylebook.com, although you do need a subscription to access it. So here's what they have to say about collective nouns. They note that nouns that denote a unit take singular verbs and pronouns. For example, class, committee, crowd, family, group, herd, jury, orchestra, and team. And then they give us some usage examples. The committee is meeting to set its agenda. The jury reached its verdict. A herd of cattle was sold. AP notes that team names and musical group names that are plural take plural verbs. For example, the Yankees are in first place. The Jonas Brothers are popular. Now, no offense, AP, but you may want to update that reference a little bit because I don't think the Jonas Brothers have been popular for some good 15 years, but that's okay. We take the point. AP also notes that team or group names with no plural form also take plural verbs, and that's kind of interesting. So their examples are the Miami Heat are battling for third place. And other examples that would take a plural verb would be the Orlando Magic, Oklahoma City Thunder, Utah Jazz, Alabama Crimson Tide, or I'll add my own favorite, the Indiana Fever. Now they note that most singular names, logically enough, take singular verbs, including place and university names in sports. Coldplay is on tour. Boston is favored in the playoffs. Stanford is in the NCAA tournament. Finally, they note that some proper names that are plural in form do take a singular verb. For example, Brooks Brothers is holding a sale. So boy, if you need to get your fancy suit, you better head down to Brooks Brothers. Alrighty, so far we've been talking about nouns in a pretty basic way. So now let's turn to a more lyrical description of nouns. And for that, I'm going to pull from a book called Sin and Syntax, How to Craft Wicked Good Prose. And this is by an author named Constance Hale. And she is the author of The Wired Style Guide and another book called Vex, Hex, Smash, and Smooch. So here's what Constance has to say about nouns. She notes that almost every English sentence contains at least one noun. They are indispensable when it comes to portraying a character or painting a scene. Let's look at a paragraph from The Pillars of Hercules, in which the travel writer Paul Thoreau describes the 720 Express to Latakia. So, Constance Hale gives us a quote from Thoreau's book, and here's what she has. There was undoubtedly a more hallucinogenic experience available in poppy-growing Turkey than a long bus ride through central Anatolia, though it was hard for me to imagine what this might be after a 23-hour trip in the sulfurous interior of a bus of chain-smoking Turks as day became twilight, turned to night, the moon passing from one side of the bus to the other, gleaming briefly in the snow of the Galatia highlands, fog setting and dispersing like phantasms, glimpses of dervishes, day dawning again, another stop, more yogurt, children crying in the back seats, full daylight in Iskenderun, rain in Antioch, all windows shut, the stale smoke condensing in brown, bitter slime on the closed windows as fresh blue fumes rose from 49 burning cigarettes in this sleepless acid trip on the slipstream of secondhand smoke. Well, I would say Constance Hale pulled a pretty amazing paragraph from Paul Thoreau's book. She notes that, like any effective scene description, this one is packed with person, place, and concrete thing and intangible thing words. For example, people. We have Turks, dervishes, children. We have places. Turkey, Central Anatolia, the interior of the bus, Iskenderun. We've got concrete things. Bus, day, night, moon, snow, fog, yogurt, back seats, rain, windows, smoke and slime, fumes and cigarettes. And then finally, he uses a number of intangible things. Experience, phantasms, glimpses, acid trip, and slipstream. She notes that some of these nouns, like bus ride, twilight, and phantasms, slide back and forth between tangible and intangible, depending on the writer's use and the reader's frame of mind. I think this section from Constance Hale's Sin and Syntax is really interesting because we often think of nouns, well, I often think of nouns as the most boring parts of the English language. We've got verbs. Those are our action words, talking about the things we do. We run and play and sing and dance. We've got adjectives. Those are the colorful words we use to describe the things around us. And adverbs, again, ways we use to colorfully describe all the different things we do. We think of nouns as kind of just like things that describe things. But Paul Thoreau and Constance Hale show us that nouns can be rich and evocative in their own right. So let's go backwards in time for just a minute and talk about the derivation of the word noun. So for that, I'm going to a really cool book. This is the American Heritage Dictionary of Indo-European Roots. And this is the third edition of this book, revised and edited by Calvert Watkins. And this book gives us essentially the prehistoric roots of English. It traces over 13,000 words back to their origins in what we call Proto-Indo-European. That's the prehistoric ancestor of English that was spoken even before the advent of writing. So let's take a look at where the word noun came from. It comes from the word nomen, and that's spelled N-O-M-N, meaning name. And we see that phrase, nomen, in all different types of other words in English. For example, nominal, nominate, noun, which is what we're talking about today. We've got binomial, cognomen, denominate, ignomy, misnomer, nomenclature, and pronoun or renown. If you spell all of those words out, you can see that N-O-M, or sometimes N-O-M-N, there in the middle. So it's pretty cool that the concept of nouns comes from the word name, because that's what nouns do. They name and give a name to all the things that are around us, from tangible things like a teddy bear or a pencil, to intangible things like beauty, one's livelihood, or the concept of caring. Now, nouns sound, from this perspective, pretty straightforward. there are things that give other things a name. But it can get a little bit more complicated. And for an example of that, we're going to turn to a book that's also presented by the University of Chicago Press. And it's called, But Can I Start a Sentence with But? And the subhead is Advice from the Chicago Style Q&A. And it has a foreword by Carol Fisher Saller, who was one of the longtime editors of the Chicago Manual of Style. Now, what is this book all about? Well, the Chicago Manual of Style, as we have said, is a super comprehensive style guide. It answers almost every question an editor or writer could have about how to use certain terms correctly in the English language. However, people are constantly coming up with questions that aren't specifically addressed in the Chicago Manual. Thus, the Chicago Manual of Style's online Q&A section was born. So every month, the editors of the manual open up their email mailbag and answer readers' questions on all different types of topics. So this book, But Can I Start a Sentence with But?, brings together some of the best of the Chicago Q&A curated from really years of entries. So let's look at one of the questions and answers that came in. And it's about the topic of, can a noun be transformed into a verb? And what's that all about? So here's the question. And you'll also notice that the person sending in the question is being a little bit sassy. They have the nerve to actually call out the editors of Chicago about a mistake that they possibly had made in one of their other Q&As. So here's what the reader sends in. They said, in the latest Q&A on your website, I noticed that an answer contained the word lowercased. Is this really a verb or another example of a noun erroneously transformed into a verb? I cannot imagine that you would have made such an error, but I've never heard that verb before. So let's hear what Chicago editors have to say in response. Here's their answer. Lowercase is a fine verb. You can look it up in a dictionary. And in any case, I don't know any rule against making a noun into a verb. Writers and speakers of good English have been verbifying for a long time, and sometimes it works out well. I understand your resistance, though. I winced recently when I heard someone say, let's see if we can solution that. In this case, using the noun solution and turning it into a really obnoxious corporate jargony verb. This topic is also addressed in one of my very favorite resource guides. It's called the New York Public Library Writer's Guide to Style and Usage. And this was possibly the first book about words and language that I ever owned, and I felt so fancy when I had it. It was published in 1994, and I actually have the first edition of it, not because I'm one of those people who seek out first editions of books, but because we just happened to buy it when it came out. Let's see what this reference has to say about this idea of turning nouns into verbs. Turning nouns into verbs, although decried by many purists, has in fact been going on for hundreds of years. Examples are words like deluge from 1593, debut from 1830, and demarcate from 1816. In most cases, the reference notes, the passage of time determines a noun's true usefulness as a verb. Using the word contact as a verb, for example, was rejected by almost two-thirds of the usage panel of the Harper Dictionary of Contemporary Usage, in the mid-1970s. By 1993, however, 69% of the usage panel of the American Heritage Dictionary, third edition, had accepted that usage. So we see how a noun may become a verb, and it may feel faddish or not proper English, so to speak, at first, but if it catches hold and becomes more and more used over time, it can sometimes gradually become accepted as a standard part of speech. So let's see what else the New York Public Library Writer's Guide says. So as another example, they say in 1980, usage expert Roy Copperud had considered the use of chair as a verb to be journalese, or what we might call corporatese. And the year before, the New York Times editor, Theodore Bernstein, had called it a fad word. However, by the 1990s, the use of chair as a verb had gained acceptance by most authorities. There's less controversy over chair as a verb than over chair as an alternative to chairman, chairwoman, or chairperson. Now, I'm going to pause there and say, let's see, this was published in 1994. So 2004, 2014, 2024, more than 30 years later, I think that chair itself has been completely accepted as a noun. In other words, we might say the person is the chair of the board or the chair of the subcommittee, and it's a really useful non-gendered term. I don't think anyone thinks that that's a faddish or novel replacement for chairman or chairwoman anymore. So again, we're seeing how language can change and evolve over time. So the New York Public Library Guide also notes that turning nouns and adjectives into verbs by adding the suffix I-Z-E, eyes, has also been an English tradition for centuries. Scandalize, for example, was first seen in writing in 1566. Today, the practice is especially popular in business and government writing. Some of these words, for example, finalize and prioritize, were considered shameless bureaucratic jargon when they first appeared. But they've become slightly less jarring over time. However, many authorities still oppose their use. So again, 30 years later, after this book was published, I'd say that finalize and prioritize are absolutely common and no one would bat an eyelash. Or, do you bat an eyelash? No one would bat an eye if they saw those terms in print. And they note that many other terms are being coined almost daily, like incentivize, gerundize, customize, and that careful writers should avoid such words until dictionaries show them gaining standard acceptance. And I would say that's still the case with incentivize, partly because there's a perfectly good word that it's replacing, to motivate. So whether incentivize will become standard English in the future, let's watch and see. For our final section of the podcast today, we're going to read from a book called Writing Tools, 50 Essential Strategies for Every Writer. And this book is written by Roy Peter Clark, who is one of our nation's greatest writing teachers. He calls himself a writer who teaches and a teacher who writes. He was with the Poynter Institute for many, many years. And if you don't know, Poynter is one of the most prestigious schools for journalism in the world. And he's written or edited many books about writing and journalism. And he also offers courses on Poynter's website. So let's see what Roy Peter Clark has to say about some nouns. He's talking about nouns in the context of using concrete details in your writing. He calls these details that leave a mark and those that stimulate the senses. So just like Constance Hale did in her book, Sin and Syntax, Roy Peter Clark is going to show us a quote from Cormac McCarthy and how he begins the novel, All the Pretty Horses. So I'll read from the quote that Roy includes in his book. The candle flame and the image of the candle flame caught in the pier glass twisted and righted when he entered the hall and again when he shut the door. He took off his hat and came slowly forward. The floorboards creaked under his boots. In his black suit, he stood in the dark glass, where the lilies leaned so palely from their wasted cut glass vase. Along the cold hallway behind him hung the portraits of forebears, only dimly known to him, all framed in glass and dimly lit above the narrow wainscoting. He looked down at the guttered candle stub. He pressed his thumbprint in the warm wax, pooled on the oak veneer. Lastly, he looked at the face so caved and drawn among the folds of funeral cloth, the yellowed mustache, the eyelids paper thin. That was not sleeping. That was not sleeping. So again, that's an excerpt from All the Pretty Horses by Cormac McCarthy. And Roy Peter Clark says of this excerpt, "Such prose demands the close attention we'd apply to poetry, starting with that glittering collection of merged nouns." And he points out, candle flame, pier glass, cut glass, candle stub, and thumbprint. We also note that the narrator presses his thumbprint in warm wax pooled not just on a table, but on the oak veneer. So McCarthy is using highly specific and highly unique nouns to set his stage and pairing those with evocative adjectives and verbs to draw us into a scene and make us feel what the narrator is feeling. And that's the power of language and how nouns, basic, simple nouns, can play a really important role in creating a moving scene that takes us from our day-to-day life into somewhere different and special and meaningful. So that's the end of today's Sleepy Time Grammar podcast. Our podcast is presented by Dragonfly Editorial. And our producer is Clock Tower Media out of Tip City, Ohio. I'm Samantha Enslin with Dragonfly Editorial, and thanks for joining us today. Read, relax, let your cares drift away into that wonderful world of words. See you next time. Thank you.
Looking for a professional team to bring your podcast or video production to life? At Clock Tower Media, we proudly edit and produce a growing lineup of shows, including The Downtown Lowdown, Newsmakers, Spectre Sisters, Cocktails and Carry-Ons, Dreams of Future Past, Talk Proper, Sleepy Grammar, and many more. Whether you're an experienced creator or just getting started, our team can help with audio editing, video production, graphics, publishing, and everything in between. We believe every great story deserves great production. Have an idea for a podcast or show? We're always looking for new productions to join the Clock Tower Media family. Visit clocktowermedia.com today and let's create something amazing together.